Before I begin, I just want to tell you a little bit about the structure of the course. I got a number of questions about the exams. Two points. People say, well, how much does a midterm count for in the final grade? Answer, 1/3. There are three components to the final grade. 1/3 for the midterm, 1/3 for the first part of the final, the in-class part, which is going to have a very similar structure to the midterm, and 1/3 for the take-home part, which is the essay, right? The other question has to do with whether the final exam is cumulative or not. Answer, yes, it's cumulative in the sense that you are expected to know the basics for the course as a whole, but the emphasis in the final exam will be on the material covered since the midterm, right? So on the chronology question, there will probably be events from before 1941 that you would be expected to put in order. But the bulk of the in-class final will be dealing with the period after 1941, okay? Do any of you have any questions about logistics or things like that? Yeah? This is Matt Gottfried. He's the reader, so he's the one that you'll be talking to if you have questions about your exam. But almost done, almost done.
So probably Friday.
Yeah, I like the way you use the expression "look forward to." All right, this is the beginning of the second. I'm sorry. What? Did someone say something? This is the beginning of the second half of the class. This class, it really does fall into these two equal parts, you know, the story up to 1941 and the story after 1941. That is a very sharp dividing line. Why? Because the events of December 1941, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the American entry into the war against Japan, followed 4 days later by the German declaration of war in the United States and America's entry into the European war. This was absolutely decisive. You know, it was clear at the time what the outcome of the war would be. As soon as America was in, it was clear that the Germans and the Japanese would be defeated because American resources were just so enormous. Dwarfed that of any of these other countries. And the Germans had their hands full in Russia. The Japanese had their hands full in China. And it wasn't even as though America was going to have to mobilize all of its resources and deploy, you know, an absolutely enormous army fighting on the European or Asian mainland. Right? You can just, you know, buckle down and start producing bombs and bombers, and you could blast your enemies to smithereens if you took long enough. This is even before atomic weapons came on the scene. Because the Germans couldn't do that to you. You had an unsinkable aircraft carrier in the British Isles. Right? We could attack the German aircraft manufacturing facilities from our bases in Britain. The Germans couldn't do anything equivalent in terms of attacking the American military industrial base. It was just too far away. So it was very clear what the outcome of the war would be. Churchill, when British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, when he heard the news of Pearl Harbor, it wasn't shock. It was delight, pure pleasure. You know, he wrote in his memoirs what his thoughts were at that time. He says, so we had won the war after all. After all the dark days of 1940, the defeat of France and all, you know, the uncertainty in early 1941 about whether the Americans would ever come in, now the outcome of the war was decided. He says, I went to sleep and I slept the sleep of the saved. You know, it's like, it's very clear what the outcome was. Clear also, for example, to the leader of the Free French, General Charles de Gaulle. said exactly the same thing. And if you understand what determines the outcome of military conflicts in the industrial age, namely industrial power, mobilizable industrial power, it is very clear. All you had to do was look at the figures of steel production in those days. You know, steel being the main indicator of military power, given the kind of military technology he had at that time. You know, outcome of the war is clear. And the implication is that what's of interest to us from the period 1941 to 45 is not so much how the war ran its course and the details of the fighting on the battlefields and Stalingrad and the Normandy invasion and all that kind of thing. A lot of military buffs are interested in that kind of problem. The really interesting thing has to do with relations among the Allied powers, because the Nazi declaration of war in the United States, followed by the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union half a year earlier, this brought a grand coalition into being. A coalition between the Soviet Union and the Western powers. The United States and Britain are very close in this period. But increasingly, because America is so much stronger than Britain, it's the American government that's calling the shots. And so its relations, above all, between the United States and the Soviet Union, that we should keep our eyes on, because it's the nature of that relationship that will determine the sort of political system that comes into being at the end of the war. In other words, is it going to be stable? What kind of relations are these two countries going to have, the United States and the Soviet Union? Absolutely fundamental at this point. Okay? I may say, well, that's not really a very difficult question. Anyone could see during the war itself that there were going to be problems in the post-war period. Here you have the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, a totalitarian state, a state based on terror, a state with this communist ideology, police state, and the United States, democratic America, believer in freedom and liberty, capitalist country. The ideological gap is so enormous between these two sides that there was bound to be trouble. Right? That's the kind of common sense view, the view that, you know, people had during the Cold War period. The Cold War, people felt, is a natural conflict. What was it? And here, what we want to do is bring international relations theory to bear, not because it's going to give us an answer to the question of what caused the Cold War, not because it provides answers, but because it brings the questions into focus. It'll help us see that there's a puzzle here. It'll help us see that the Cold War is profoundly puzzling. Why? Because countries are concerned with power realities. They have to be concerned with power realities. Their survival depends on their ability to be sensitive to power realities. And what the basic situation at the end of the war is, the Soviet Union, Soviet forces occupy, you know, Eastern Europe up to the middle of Germany. And the Western powers occupy Western Europe, again, up to the middle of Germany. There's a line of demarcation between those two areas of occupation stretching right down the center of Europe. Okay. And from a realist perspective, from a theoretical perspective, you look at this stuff and you say, so what's the problem? That's the solution. They call the shots in the east. We call the shots in the west. We respect Eastern Europe as their sphere of influence. They respect Western Europe as our sphere of influence. On that basis, the two sides can get along with each other. Right? We might not like the fact that Eastern Europe is now under communist control. We might not like the Stalinist regime in Russia. But we're not going to go to war with them to change that. We're not going to go to war with them to eject them from Eastern Europe, because our core interests are not at stake there. And similarly, they might like the idea of communizing all of Europe and of extending their control over all of Europe and seeing communist regimes spread around the world, but they're not going to go to war with us to kick us out of Western Europe, right? As much as both sides have their ideological preferences and what they would like, they're not going to go to war to achieve those goals. The acceptance of the status quo of a divided Europe is vastly preferable to a third world war for both sides. And if that's the case, you look at the whole situation, you say, where's the problem? Why is this a problem? Shouldn't it have been obvious that the two sides could live with each other? Okay? That's the puzzle of the Cold War. That's the central puzzle of the Cold War. And understanding what that puzzle is acts as a kind of springboard that enables you to kind of sort things out. Weren't the two sides able to see that? See, you understand the basic conception here is that here you have these two states, the United States and the Soviet Union, both very ideological countries. Obviously different ideologies, but they're both very ideological. And yet, political realities, power realities, force them to pull in their horns in terms of how much weight they're going to give to ideological considerations. You know, political realities, the fact that the other half of Europe is dominated by a very strong country and you don't want to go to war with that country, right? That means they have an enormous incentive to work things out on the basis of those political realities, the division of Europe, the status quo of a divided Europe, where each side controls its half of Europe. Right? That's the kind of vision that you get from thinking about these issues on a theoretical level, from bringing basic concepts of international relations theory to bear. As I say, it doesn't answer the question, but it defines the puzzle. It doesn't help us figure it out. In a sense, it explains something that didn't happen. A spheres of influence piece from the very outset. Didn't happen. Instead, you have a Cold War, which dominates international politics, certainly through the early 60s in a real way, and then in a more attenuated way until the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. And the Cold War itself is the third great conflict, the fourth great conflict that we're interested in examining here to get some insight into these basic problems of how international politics works. We're interested in the First World War, including American intervention in the First World War. We're interested in the origins of the Second World War in Europe, the origins of the U.S.-Japanese War of 1941, and now we're interested in the Cold War. But the Cold War is actually more interesting than those other conflicts. You know why? Because it's not simply the Cold War as a conflict that we're interested in. We're also interested in the Cold War as a political system, because the Cold War eventually evolved into a perfectly stable political system. You know, people accepted the basic political structure that came into being during the Cold War period. It provided a certain stability, so much so that leading international relations theorists like John Mearsheimer wrote soon after the Cold War ended, in the early 1990s, why we will soon come to miss the Cold War. It provided a nice structure that everyone could live within. It provided a stable structure for international affairs. See? Well, how did that happen? It obviously didn't happen overnight. What's the process? Right? Examining that question is going to give us insight into these fundamental issues. So how do you go about answering those fundamental questions? Well, the basic strategy we're using in this class is we define the questions, and then we try and reconstruct the story to see what light the story sheds on those questions. And what determines the story? How do you figure out what the story was? Well, you want to see what each side wants, what each side's goals were. and try and identify the logic underlying the cause of the course of events. Okay, war itself, until the last year of the war, not much happens in terms of Allied diplomacy that points to how these issues are going to be resolved in the future. Why? Because no one wants to bring problems to a head. People want to kind of sweep things under the rug for the time being, because the important thing is to win the war. And the hope is that all this wartime camaraderie, you know, comrades in arms, East and West, that'll carry over into the post-war period. We'll work things out. Let's not worry about the terms of peace now. Big mistake, 1918, agreeing to a negotiated armistice. And that allowed the Germans to say they weren't really defeated. German territory was never occupied, and so on. Now the Allies are going to insist on unconditional surrender. Unconditional surrender meant that you didn't have to worry about peace terms. It means they'll surrender, and then we'll worry about peace terms. Because to talk about peace terms is going to bring the differences between the Soviet Union and the Western powers out into the open. But by late 1944, you can't do that anymore. Why? Because the Soviets are moving into Poland. And the whole question of what sort of political regime is going to be constructed in the areas that were being conquered or liberated, if you prefer to use that term, couldn't be avoided. And Poland, why was Poland so important? It's important because, well, for all kinds of reasons. Poland was the issue that had led to the war in the first place. That's why the British and the French had gone to war in 1939. Are they going to stand up for the independence and territorial integrity of Poland? And now they're just going to walk away from that commitment? And there are domestic political reasons, especially in the United States, for concerning yourself with Poland. A lot of Polish Americans concentrated in swing states in the Midwest, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, very important in domestic political terms. Poland's important to the Soviets because of its geographical location. There it is, right astride the invasion path between Germany and Russia. Control of Poland was very different from Soviet interest in, say, Greece or Yugoslavia or Finland or anything like that. Poland, you know, was important for strategic reasons. And it was becoming clear that the Soviets were going to impose a communist regime on Poland. They didn't believe that the Poles would cooperate with the USSR and their own volition. The Poles didn't like the idea of Soviet troops in their territory in 1939. So the fear was once they're in, they'll never leave. Right. So and the Poles were very anti-Soviet, in fact, anti-Russian. And so the idea was the only way you can control them was by having a knife to their throats. And that meant, imposing a communist regime, a communist police state on that country. And that's, in fact, what the Soviets were in the course of the process of doing as they moved further and further into Polish territory in late 1944. And the Americans saw what was happening. And the Americans and the British felt like, well, they had to kind of speak up and try and work out this Polish thing with Stalin. And so that's why a conference was held at Yalta in the Crimea, on Soviet territory, April of 1945. Right. Here's President Roosevelt. You know, he's a dying man. He has congestive heart failure. And he brings himself to get in these World War II vintage aircraft and fly halfway around the world, so that he can meet with Stalin on Soviet territory to try and work out this Polish business. And in fact, at the Yalta Conference in April of 1945, an agreement was reached. This big myth that at Yalta, Europe was divided and Poland was turned over to the Soviet sphere, etc., etc. It's not true. As we'll see, it's Potsdam, not Yalta, that's the real Spheres of Influence Conference. What was agreed at Yalta about Poland? There was this government that proto-government that the Soviets were setting up. It was based for a time in a city in eastern Poland called Lublin. And so this is called the Lublin government, right? The communist government. Communist-dominated government. And there was also the Polish government in exile. It was based in London. And so the whole idea was that you would reconstruct the Polish government, taking the Lublin government as the base, but bringing in representatives of the London Poles and of anti-Nazi Poles from the interior of Poland. And this would form the basis of a provisional government of national unity. Okay. Again, note the communists were, it was understood the communists would play the leading role, but not absolute control. And that provisional government was scheduled was required to hold free and unfettered elections, and those elections would result in the final government of Poland. So Stalin basically was agreeing that ultimately the government of Poland would be based on free elections, but the provisional government would be a communist-dominated government. British, the Americans, including the professionals and the Foreign Office and so on, they were delighted by these arrangements. Stalin had given a whole lot more than they had hoped for. Okay? But the problem was it was just words. And the reality was that the communist grip on the country, the communists in Poland, backed up by the Red Army and the Soviet secret police, that was then called the NKVD, were rounding up anti-communist Poles and so on. And generally, they were in the process of imposing a communist police state. Slowly at first, in order to kind of preserve appearances, but people understood what was happening. And Roosevelt, I'm sorry, did I say April 1945? I think actually Yalta was February of 1945, if I'm not mistaken. Roosevelt, shortly before his death in April of 1945, he wrote to Stalin to express his disappointment at the way the Soviets were not living up to their side of the Yalta bargain. That this was we could not go along with an arrangement that was simply a cloak for imposing a communist police state on Poland. Right? Roosevelt dies, as I say, in April. And is replaced by Harry Truman, the vice president, who's a total novice in all of these things. And Truman learns the basics about this whole Polish business, and he meets the Soviet foreign minister Molotov. Molotov was stopped off in Washington to meet Truman on his way to San Francisco. There was a conference in San Francisco where the United Nations Charter was to be worked out and stuff. So according to Truman's account of this meeting, he was very tough with Molotov. And he basically says, you're not living up to what you promised at Yalta. And Molotov, according to Truman, gets all upset. And he says, I've never been talked to that way in my life. And Truman points at him. He says, well, you keep your promises and you won't get talked to that way. So it's somewhat apocryphal because Truman's memoirs were written at the height of the Cold War. He had an interest in making himself seem a lot tougher than he in fact was. But the key point is that he did take a relatively tough line with Molotov. And it seemed like the United States was slamming its fist on the table. But Truman very rapidly changed course. And the following month, May of 1945, he's very upset about the collapse of the wartime alliance and doesn't want to take responsibility for that, and totally changes the Polish policy. It is important because a lot of people think that this dispute over Poland was what triggered the Cold War. It's not true. He sends Roosevelt's closest advisor, a man named Harry Hopkins, over to Moscow in May to work things out with Stalin. And they do work out this deal where basically the communist-dominated government is recognized as the government of Poland. Right? This settles the Polish problem as far as the Americans are concerned. Yeah. The communists continue tightening their grip on that country. The Americans don't care. Right? When Truman meets with Stalin and Churchill at Potsdam in July of 1945, we don't bring up the Polish business at all. We don't say to the Russians, look, you know, you promised there'd be free elections in Poland, but in fact, a communist police state is being imposed on that country. That's totally unacceptable. You know, none of that. You read to me this is a big surprise. You read the Potsdam documents, and you don't find any of that stuff at all. And in fact, what was surprising to historians who went through all this stuff is that Truman had very little problem accepting a communist-dominated Poland. Truman had very little problem accepting a Soviet-controlled Eastern Europe. You know, I put on in the supplementary readings for this week a link to a document. From the Forrestal Diaries. Forrestal was then Secretary of the Navy. And he was talking about a meeting he had with Truman at Potsdam, in which Truman was basically saying, well, thanks to Hitler, the Soviets are right there in the heart of Europe. He says, it looks like we're going to be faced with a Soviet dominated, as we said, a Slav Europe for a long time to come. And then he says, I don't think it's so bad. Says, I could get along with Uncle Joe. Right? That's the Americans, once their fundamental interests were safeguarded, didn't have too much problem accommodating Soviet interests. And what is our fundamental interest in Europe? Why did we get involved in the European war to begin with? Because we didn't want and felt it would be inconsistent with our own security if a single hostile power controlled all the vast resources of Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. Right? There was a danger that Hitler would achieve a position of that sort. There was also a danger that the Soviets might dominate all of Europe. If the United States controlled Western Europe, the Soviets were kept at bay, Western Europe, the industrial resources in Western Europe, a lot greater than in Eastern Europe, right? America's interests would be preserved. There would be no threat of this Eurasian colossus, you know, threatening American security interests in the future. If we could achieve that, we could live with things. We're not going to go to war to eject them from Poland, force them to accept a democratic democratic arrangement for Poland. Right? So by May, we've accepted Poland. If you're not going to stand up for Poland, are you going to stand up for Romania, Bulgaria, any of these other countries in Eastern Europe? No, Poland, you had a certain moral commitment to. Poland is an important country. These other countries, no. In the long run, the Polish thing was a touchstone. If you're going to accept the Soviet-dominated Poland, you're going to accept the Soviet-dominated Eastern Europe as a whole. So you see, even before the war is over, both sides are being led to think in spheres of influence terms. The Soviets as well. Soviets as well. Stalin is a practitioner of power politics. He views himself as the heir of the Tsars. He thinks in terms of Russian national interests. Right? He's willing to accommodate American power. I mean, Bolshevism, communism, is a materialist philosophy. Marxism places great emphasis on economic considerations, and American economic power was by no means ignored by the Soviets. And so you find Stalin in the spring of 1945 telling the Yugoslav communist Milovan Djilas, a very famous quotation, he says, this war is not like any other. Each side imposes its political and social system as far as its armies reach, implying that all the areas in Eastern Europe that were liberated by the Red Army, they would have communist systems. But so when the Gielis' memoirs came out, people in the West pointed this and say, look how awful Stalin was. He intended to communize all these areas that the Soviet Army controlled from the very outset. But the real meaning of that GLS quote was that Stalin was accepting a spheres of influence arrangement for all of Europe, because it wasn't just the Soviets that were imposing their political system in the areas they controlled. The United States was also going to impose its political system on Western Europe, which is, of course, what happened. Happened in both cases. So how could you blame Stalin for making what would turn out to be a very astute political prediction? It wasn't just that. After the reunification of Germany, the former East German archives fell into the hands of people in the Federal Republic, and they found a document recording a meeting that the East German communist leaders had with Stalin. This is on June 4th, 1945. Again, after the Hopkins mission, but before Potsdam. And the Stalin did is he predicted in German, to the Germans, that there would be two Germanies, two German states. That Germany would be divided. Right? Again, turned out it was an astute prediction. You could see the kind of people on both sides coming to see that a system was taking shape. Soviets would control the East. Americans and their friends would control the West. Okay. That's the background for Potsdam. At Potsdam, even before Potsdam, people are moving in that direction. Spheres of influence. And Potsdam is extremely important, very important conference, because it marked the beginning of an understanding between the Soviets and the Americans about what the post-war system would be. That it would be based on a divided Europe, a divided Germany. Okay, what's the proof of all this? All has to do with the policy pursued by the real maker of U.S. policy in this period. Not Truman, who was something of a cipher, but his Secretary of State, a remarkable man. His name is James Burns. And Burns kind of looked at the whole history of U.S.-Soviet relations from Yalta on. It says, what did they take away from Yalta? The Soviets hadn't lived up to their agreements? Right. There were no free elections in Poland. The whole spirit of Yalta was the Soviets had reneged on what they had promised. This doesn't mean you're going to have to go to war with them. What it means is that we can't have true political intimacy with these people. And we can't relate to them the same way we relate to the British, for example. Right? And so what's the solution? If we can't have political intimacy with them, we can't run Germany with them together as a unit. Right? If we try and do that, there will be endless quarrels, endless disputes. Right? It's not going to work. The simplest solution, the easiest solution, the solution that makes most sense is let them run the part of Germany they control, and we'll run the part of Germany we control. Germany had been divided into zones. This was an agreement that had been reached in late 1944. There's a Soviet zone, which was to become the East German state, but other parts of pre-war Germany were given to Poland, and even a little part here around Königsberg was given to Russia itself. It still is part of Russia to this very day. Let them control what the part of Germany that they occupy. They could do with it as they wish. We'll control the part of Germany that that we and our friends occupy. This is the basic Burns conception. Let me back up a little bit and explain to you how American thinking had evolved. During the war, they didn't want to touch the German issue, right, for the reasons that I talked about before, but actually it was somewhat deeper than that. So I have a little bit of time, so I'll actually play you this thing. Because why was it they didn't come up with a policy for dealing with Germany after the war, during the war years? The answer was that it's very hard to know what the solution to that problem is. What are you supposed to do? You know, treat Germany very harshly and enrage them in the future, and are you going to run them as a colony for the rest of human history? It's like, you don't want to go that route. On the other hand, given all the extraordinary crimes that the Germans had committed, both in causing the war and also even more in terms of what happened during the course of the war, the way it was fought and so on, well, you weren't going to just turn the other cheek and pretend that it didn't happen. Treat Germany very softly. And I'm going to actually play you a song. This is written by a famous British songwriter, Noel Coward, in 1943, to kind of ridicule all these notions that we should have a soft peace with Germany. This is called "Don't Let's Be Beastly to the Germans." Let's see if I can get it here.
The Sondheim Now Been Singer was written during the war years as a satire directed against a small minority of excessive humanitarians who, in my opinion, are taking a rather too tolerant view of our enemies. It is called "Don't Let's Be Beastly to the Germans."
Okay, that's Noel Coward. You see, it's like making fun of these notions of, oh, we should have a soft peace. But you don't want a soft peace, but a harsh peace. Is that going to be viable? So people wanted to avoid this problem. It was, and just kind of put it off till the end of the war. Well, Germany's defeated in May of 1945, and the victor powers, the Soviets, the Americans, and the British, they meet outside of Berlin in Potsdam in July and August. And they have this immediate problem of how to run Germany, and especially how to deal with the German reparations. Again, the reparations turn out to be a very important issue in terms of its political implications at the end of World War II as at the end of World War I. Because the Soviets, the Red Army, is just going into all the areas that it occupies, and it's just stripping them bare, taking, you know, dismantling all these factories, shipping the factories back to Russia. And the issue arises, well, how are you going to deal with the reparations? And given what the Soviets are doing, it's very hard to think it could be dealt with on an all-German basis. So Burns comes up with this idea that the key to the reparation settlement should be let the Soviets do what they want with the East, with all the stripping and so on. We're not going to be able to prevent them from doing it anyway. But on the other hand, we should basically call the shots in the part of Germany we control in terms of how reparation is to be extracted. Not just that, but the Soviets are going to be given a certain share of the industrial equipment in Western Germany that's judged unnecessary for the German peacetime economy. You know, 10% of this they're going to be given outright, and another 15% they're going to be given in exchange for food and raw materials from the East. So the idea is not to slam the door in the Soviets' face. We want it. We're going to give them stuff that, strictly speaking, we didn't have to give them. And we have this barter arrangement of the 15%, which suggests right away that Germany is not being treated as a unit, because if we're being treated as a unit economically, you wouldn't have this barter between the two halves of Germany. Okay. But the basic idea of the Burns Plan is each side takes from its part of Germany what it wants. It doesn't have to clear it with the Allies. The implication of this is that Germany's foreign trade is not going to be run on a unitary basis by the four powers acting as a bloc. Germany's foreign trade, exports and imports, will also have to be managed on a zonal basis. Because if the Soviets are stripping the Eastern Zone isn't going to be able to produce as much as it can in order to earn through exports what it needs to finance essential imports of, you know, food and raw materials. And if the Germans, if the Soviets are the ones who are causing this problem, they're going to have to deal with it themselves. If Germany were run on a unitary basis, the Americans would have to foot part of the bill for whatever deficit Germany as a whole was running. And so, in effect, we would be footing part of the bill for what the Soviets were doing in stripping the Eastern Zone. We're not going to do it. It's like Truman, Burns, they were American nationalists. We shouldn't have to pay for what the Soviets are doing. Let them deal with the consequences themselves. But the other side of that coin is, we'll manage exports and imports in our zone, and in fact, in the three Western zones. The French are also given a zone in Germany. The assumption is that the three Western powers will be able to run Western Germany as a unit. So this is a clear assumption in Potsdam documents. And if Germany is run as two separate units for purposes of foreign trade, well, that suggests that the overall economic treatment of Germany will also be done not on a unitary basis, but on a zonal basis. There'll be one set of arrangements for running the German economy in the East, and another set of arrangements in the West. Right? And so if Germany is being divided for economic purposes, well then, that certainly suggests that Germany is going to be divided for political purposes, because the state structures that are going to come into being are state structures that will serve to run the German economy in each of the two parts of Germany. So it's understood that all of this stuff, the Burns Reparation Plan, the implications of that plan for the treatment of German foreign trade, for the treatment, for the overall economic treatment of Germany, and therefore, you know, that all of that stuff implies that Germany is going to be divided politically between East and West, and that this is not a hostile thing. This is the solution to the problem of how the two sides can get along. Pull apart. That's the Burns philosophy. Okay? And Stalin senses this, reacts very positively to what Burns was proposing at Potsdam. Okay? it takes the lead in extending the Burns concept to various other provisions in the arrangements that were being set up. Above all, the provision for the divvying up of Germany's foreign assets. Foreign assets located in countries to the east of the line of demarcation in Europe, Stalin proposes, this goes to the Soviets. To the west of the line of demarcation, this goes to the Allies. Again, you look at the way these issues are discussed, straight spheres of influence talk. Now, all this stuff is secret at the time. The public is given a very different and misleading impression of what was agreed at Potsdam, because there's all this talk in the Potsdam Protocol of running Germany as a unit, not taken seriously by either the Americans or the Soviets. You could actually demonstrate these things. All right. So you have a kind of meeting of the minds taking place at Potsdam. This is the way Europe is going to be run. And it's a basic philosophy that drives both U.S. and Soviet diplomacy in the rest of 1945, from Potsdam to the Moscow Conference of December of 1945. The basic idea here for Burns was that we will reach an understanding with the Soviets so that Europe will be divided on a friendly basis. We will accept their control of Eastern Europe. The big issue between East and West in late 1945 was not Poland. It was the fate of Romania and Bulgaria, where the communists were in the process of imposing police states. And Burns, at the London Conference in September of 1945, makes it very clear to the Soviets over and over again, look, what happened in Poland, we could take as a model for how to settle Bulgaria and Romania. And by this time, it's abundantly clear what happened in Poland is that the communists are taking over there. This is okay with the Americans. Right? And was it as though Burns was just such an appeaser that he didn't know what he was doing and incompetent? No, because we're getting important things in exchange, most notably vis-a-vis Japan. Soviets hadn't been at war with Japan until the very end, you know. There's basically the Americans conducted the wars, the Americans who took the defeat of Japan, and the Americans that insisted from the start on having absolute control of the occupation regime in Japan. And Stalin accepts this. And the Americans make the argument that the same principle that applied in Eastern Europe, that the occupying country calls the shots, should apply in Japan. Again, and by making that argument, they're accepting, in effect, the legitimacy of what the Soviets are doing in Eastern Europe. And it's not just Eastern Europe and Japan, but there are, you know, but basically Stalin holds back the communist parties in the areas under Western control. Abandons the communists in Greece. You know, makes it clear to the Italian communists and the French communists that serious revolutionary activity is off the table. Right? So this is the problem. December 1945, basically the culmination of negotiations that had been going on through October and November. Finally, in December of 1945, Burns and Stalin meet with the British Foreign Minister, British Foreign Secretary, I should say, Ernest Bevin. Distinctly a number three man, basically imposed himself on the Americans and the Russians. Stalin and Burns reached this understanding at Moscow. You know, it's symbolized by the American decision to recognize the communist regimes now in Romania and Bulgaria. But the Soviets also make it quite clear that they accept American control of areas on the American side of the line, above all Japan. Far more important country than Romania or Bulgaria. Right? So it would seem that by the end of... Oh, I'll get you a second. It would seem that by the end of 1945, peace is at hand. Right? The two sides have reached an agreement. Yeah, what's the agreement? You control the areas where that your armies occupy, we'll control the areas our armies occupy. It's as though the basic logic of the system based on power, had asserted itself and people had accepted the implications. But it was not to be, right? not to be, because just within a few months of that, by early 1946, it's February, March 1946, the Cold War breaks out. The two sides are screaming at each other. Yeah. How did it happen? Right? How did it happen? To answer that question is to understand what caused the Cold War. And that question is going to be at the focus of the analysis next time. So before I end, you had a question? I'm sorry? Yeah. Americans had total control of the occupation government in Japan. We didn't want to let anyone, even you know, the British or the Australians or anything like that, any of those other countries play any serious role there at all.